All right. So a question that came in very early on in our talk, is sternal or lateral recumbency better for general anesthesia recovery of brachycephalics?
Great question. And the answer is sternal through and through, especially because anatomically speaking, most of them are more barrel shaped. And so they actually tend to maintain sternal recumbency more readily than lateral recumbency. The only time that this can be a bit complicated is some of our brachycephalics with just all that extra oropharyngeal tissue. And it's just heavy, and their tongue is seemingly thicker. And so sometimes in sternal recumbency, I will actually use a rolled bit of tape or something in between two of their canine teeth. And this goes for dogs and cats, just to prop their mouths open a little bit in sternal so that it helps them to maintain that airway until they can lift their own head.
Now, our next question is, if you pre-medicate the animal with trazodone or gabapentin, for the injectable agents, are there any dose adjustments?
So not meaningfully. It's highly unlikely that your trazodone or your gabapentin ahead of time is going to provide enough sedation to really count as your sedative. And as most of our sedative drugs work through different mechanisms of action, I don't really dose reduce. So the doses that I've given in that chart are fine to give, even if your patient has come in on trazodone or gabapentin or trazodone and gabapentin sometimes.
Yes, some of our patients do need it, don't they? On the discussion of pre-medications, we have a question about that says, could you please talk about fentanyl as a pre-med? Could it be used with low-dose dexmedetomidine as a pre-med before orthopedic surgery with an FLK CRI intraoperatively?
Sure. That being said, fentanyl IM doesn't work all that well. So unless you are in the habit of placing IV catheters prior to pre-medication, in your patient population, you'll often find that you need a different drug. And the reason that fentanyl doesn't work all that great IM is because it's pretty short duration of action. But absolutely, if you have a patient who comes complete with an IV catheter and you're going to give your pre-medications IV, fentanyl absolutely could be used and then followed up with the fentanyl CRI. Just remember that your fentanyl only lasts for about 20 to 30 minutes. So you want to get that CRI going pretty quickly.
And another opioid question, which I believe was related to your slide and your discussion about methadone and its NMDA antagonism. The question is, does that mean methadone can cut through wind-up?
Great question. We don't know. So the two drugs that ha in the NMDA receptor antagonist category that have actually been evaluated for this are ketamine and amantadine. So we don't have any reason to expect that other NMDA antagonists don't perform the same way. That being said, however, in both the human literature and the veterinary literature, there's no conclusive decision, so to speak, on what kind of dose and what kind of duration of dosing is necessary to truly break that wind up. So when we're using methadone, and assuming that it will help with our patients with pre-existing painful conditions because of the NMDA antagonism, we are often considering that and then going on to say a ketamine infusion or so on. But even if you don't, there's probably enough evidence around ketamine that even single injections can potentially provide some help.
Okay. So your preference would be for ketamine if you've got a patient that needs.
More like I would give my methadone, but I would probably then continue on to intraoperative maintenance with some ketamine and CRI as well.
Okay. Now this question came through in our chat, and I thought I actually haven't heard this before, but the question says, we have probably all heard no face, no ace. So what dose would you use for brachycephalics? Which I think
Okay.
did have a dose right up there, but I guess the question is, would you reduce that dose at all? to
Technically. So the no face, no ace used to be because there was a fair amount of fear around that potential for relaxation of that soft tissue in the oropharyngeal region. And while I think that that certainly exists, I believe that our alpha twos actually are more likely to do that because they have more meaningful muscle relaxation. I don't meaningfully reduce my ACE dose, but that being said, if you have a look at that chart, you'll notice that the doses of ACE that I recommend are quite conservative compared to what's out there. So if you look in the Plum's veterinary drug formulary, the doses of ACE run anywhere from 0.005 mg per kg up to something like 0.2 mg per kg. So a really wide dosage range, whereas my doses are more conservative to begin with and quite a bit closer to the lower end of that. So no, I don't technically reduce, but if you work in a practice that routinely gives much larger doses of ACE to your patients, then maybe your brachycephalics would be a good instance to consider reducing.
Do you have, do you find that with the extended onset of action of the ACE that the patients, I guess, how long would you leave them after pre-medicating them with ACE before you actually go in?
So again, because most of the patients in my setting, I'm providing IM pre-meds. So I'll generally leave my ACE patients for 20 to 30 minutes before I start trying to place the catheter. Now, if I've pre-medded IV, I'll probably wait 5 minutes or so before induction, but then I also know that I still have a patient that's going to need to go through all their surgical prep and everything else like that. So by the time we're through all those things, the ACE will be kicking in and giving me a bit more of a balanced anesthetic during my procedure.
Okay. We had a couple of questions about the recovery and leaving the ET tube in. If we leave the ET tube in until the dog is actively chewing or is walking around with it, is there any danger or risk to the dog actually chewing the ET tube up and making it difficult to remove?
So look, it's not impossible, but, and again, that example of the dog walking around your wards is probably a bit of an extreme example, but generally speaking, we want them to be actively chewing. Now, brachycephalics tend to not have very aligned dentition either. So it's actually quite hard for them to chew the tube in half because they actually don't have teeth that line up to create that cutting surface. And so I don't worry too much about that. But I also keep somebody right there with my patient, always observing and taking care of them until they're extubated.
I had a French bulldog try and recover, and it wanted to spit out that ET tube as soon as it was conscious. And as soon as I took it out, because it was chewing it, it was like, oh, that was a bad idea. Give it back. Give it back.
Yes. Yes, Wade, I like that. I also find, and this is completely subjective, but younger dogs tend to be a little bit more objectionable about the tubes quicker than the older dogs. Older dogs seem to realize I've had a lifetime of pain and why don't I just keep this for a while?
Do you find the same with cats? When do you extubate the brachycephalic cat?
Great question. So a lot of people advocate for extubating cats before the first swallow. And their reasoning behind that is avoiding laryngeal spasm, which obviously cats are at much higher risk than dogs for. And they sort of bolster that by the belief that cats are less likely to have the reflux and regurg issues that dogs are. In my brachycephalics, because they do still have a lot of the anatomic conditions, I'll definitely keep those cats intubated at least until they are swallowing. I may not wait for them to chew the way I do with dogs, but I definitely keep them a bit longer than my average cat. Now, if you're concerned about laryngospasm and you've sprayed them with lidocaine beforehand, if your procedure was quite short, remember that your lidocaine lasts for about 45 minutes to an hour on those arytenoids. So it's probably still working if you had a short procedure. And if you had a longer procedure, it would be okay to give a little bit more lidocaine on the arytenoids because, again, your initial dose has worn off.
Okay. Now, I've just got a question here, which I guess is looking for some tips on shortening ET tubes. How do you do it?
Oh, literally with scissors. So you don't want to shorten it so short that it's deep hiding inside the mouth. But if I do realize, I try to pre-measure my tubes next to the animal's neck before I intubate them. So I have an idea of how long that they should be. And before I ever get around to induction, I'll cut them down to size. Now, if I have a centimeter or so of extra length, that's okay. But that, whatever that was, the 10 centimeters or something on that tube, that's a bit too much. The only thing that's worth noting is if you cut the tubes down to size, you can't shorten them any further than the pilot balloon valve comes out, because then they won't be able to inflate the cuff on the tube. And if you cut them down, you may need a size down for the tube adapter to your breathing circuit. So for instance, if you have a size 5 endotracheal tube and you cut the tube down to length, you may need to put a size 4 endotracheal tube adapter in there. Now, if you're not like our practice that has a pile of old tube adapters, the other thing you can do is put your scissors into the end of the tube and expand them a little bit, and it can stretch out the silicone so you can fit your size 5 back in there.
So you would take, do you normally take the circuit connector off before you cut it, or do you just kind of cut it and then try and wriggle the tube connector off the end?
Probably both. I guess I probably don't think too much about it. I'd say probably take it off the end and then cut it. If you jiggle them back and forth, they come free pretty easily.
All right. Now, this is probably more of just a general anesthesia question. If methadone has been used in a pre-med for a relatively short procedure, if you want to give buprenorphine for post-op analgesia, can that be given pretty much whenever you want to, or how long is it before?
Absolutely. So our methadone lasts for probably about 3 to 4 hours reliably. So it depends how invasive your procedure was and whether you want that pure mu opioid agonism to hang out for most of that time. The thing to remember about buprenorphine is that it's actually got a higher affinity for the mu receptor compared to all of our other opioids. And what affinity means is how badly it wants to grab onto that mu receptor. So buprenorphine actually can grab onto the mu receptor, hold on really tight, and it's really hard to kick it off. So if you have methadone on board and you give that buprenorphine, you're going to kick off the methadone. Now, if you're getting towards the end of the methadone, chances are there's lots of mu receptors that are ready and waiting and don't really have any methadone on them anyhow. So it just depends how long do you want that pure mu opioid agonism versus how soon are you ready to start getting the partial agonism.
Okay. And another question about the opioids. If you pre-medicate with one of the opioids, so butorphanol, buprenorphine, or methadone, would you still use fentanyl during surgery for a short analgesic?
Yes, absolutely. So if I was using, say, a fentanyl CRI during surgery, I might be using that to reach a more steady state of analgesia. Because if I use a single injection of, say, methadone in my pre-med, as soon as that drug starts getting metabolized, my level of analgesia is going to start decreasing a little bit because my drug concentration is going to start decreasing a little bit. Now, if I then start a fentanyl CRI, I can achieve a more steady state of analgesia in that patient. In addition to that, I can reduce the inhalant needs, as I talked about on the inhalant slide. That being said, however, you mentioned butorphanol and buprenorphine. Remember that what I just said about buprenorphine and the high affinity, it will be very hard for fentanyl to kick the buprenorphine off the mu receptor. And so you'll need much larger doses of fentanyl to try to outcompete the buprenorphine. And the butorphanol, remember, is a mu antagonist. So you would be trying to kick the butorphanol off of that mu, where it's blocking the mu essentially, in order to attempt to get the fentanyl analgesia. So again, if you're considering fentanyl analgesia during your procedure, it sounds like it's a bit of an invasive procedure and you definitely shouldn't be considering buprenorphine or butorphanol in your pre-med.
So if you had used butorphanol in your pre-med and then realized that your procedure was actually more invasive than you initially thought, would you be expecting
You get a little sad.
Would you be expecting to have to use more of like a fentanyl to get?
Yeah. I joke, but you get a little sad, you stamp your feet, then you start the fentanyl and realize you're probably going to need slightly higher doses to achieve what you want to achieve. But it happens all the time. I mean, in my world, we often get the case that presents to the emergency center that seems to be a fairly straightforward pancreatitis, and they give it some butorphanol to send it for an abdominal ultrasound. And oh, by the way, they find it's raging foreign body that needs to be removed, and now it's on my table. Super common event. And yeah, you just use slightly higher doses and it'll be okay.
Okay. What do you think about epidurals to help reduce general anesthesia doses for painful procedures?
If you are doing a procedure of the caudal abdomen or you're doing a procedure of the hind limbs, that can be super useful. Remember, I'm assuming when you're speaking of epidurals that you're probably speaking of a morphine plus local anesthetic based epidurals. And remember that that morphine can last for about 12 hours and does run the risk of urinary retention. So I don't generally recommend them unless you plan on hospitalizing the patient for at least the night to make sure that it is able to urinate appropriately. And unfortunately, it's impossible to predict what patients that's going to happen in. Generally, if it does happen, it resolves fairly quickly. However, I did once have a patient that spent 3 days hospitalized getting its bladder squeezed out until it was able to regain normal voluntary urinary function.
Mm-hmm. Do you find epidurals easy to do in brachycephalics?
It's a hard question because I do heaps of epidurals. So I don't find epidurals particularly difficult myself. Smaller the patient is, the smaller their intervertebral space is going to be. And the other thing with brachycephalics is remember that they sometimes have vertebral abnormalities that can make your anatomy just very different. But inherently, in my hands at least, not all that much harder. But again, there you're talking to the person who does lots and lots of them. It's hard to remember.
Now, the use of anticholinergics in brachycephalics, would you do it routinely or only when needed?
Just in general, even taking brachycephalics out of the equation, it somewhat depends on where you've trained. I trained at an institution that believed in anticholinergics for treatment and only using for prevention if there was a true pathology that was going to be exacerbated by the anesthetic. Like, for instance, a patient with severe second degree AV block prior to induction, or a patient with like sick sinus syndrome or something like that. So I'm in the camp of use them to treat versus routine use. You'll meet other people who will say, oh no, I use them routinely. I'm not necessarily sure there's a right answer to that. There's nothing in the literature that necessarily states that it's advantageous to have them versus disadvantageous to have them.
All right. I think that is all of our questions. And again, as I said, if you have a question that hasn't been answered, because I have left a couple of these questions that you would like answered, please feel free to email us at thinkanesthesia@jurox.com.au. Just a reminder, this webinar has been recorded and will be on our Think Anesthesia website in roughly a week. So please feel free to share it with your friends and colleagues. There is a post-webinar quiz that will either have appeared in a browser window if you will, if you use the are viewing the webinar on a computer, or there will also be a link that will be sent out to you in your follow-up email, which will be about 23 hours or so from now. We all encourage you to have a look around the Think Anesthesia website if you haven't already at our existing on-demand webinars. And we also encourage suggestions for any webinar topics that you may want to see in the future. We're also on Facebook, so please follow us under Think Anesthesia ANZ in order to stay informed of upcoming events and our webinars. So I'd like to thank you very much, Jen, for your informative webinar tonight. And to everyone who is still listening, have a very good evening, morning, afternoon, or day, depending on where you are in the world. And we hope that you have enjoyed our webinar and hope to see you next time.
Thank you all.